WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Pat Ford. There are two kinds of refugees in this crisis in the Middle East. Thousands of guest workers have fled Iraq and Kuwait, ending up in refugee camps in Jordan. Then there's the Kuwaiti ruling family. On the day Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, they were vacationing on the Côte d'Azur along with 500 of their wealthy subjects. Our guest today, Joe Stork, has studied and written about the haves and the have-nots in the Middle East. Stork is the co-founder and program director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, which publishes Middle East Report. Stork also edits the magazine, and he's the author of the book Middle East Oil and the Energy Crisis. Stork spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet.
As you can imagine, we're dealing with a region that, of course, in the popular imagination, is fantastically wealthy. It's oil rich, right? That's true at a certain level, but that oil is restricted geographically to a couple of regions, primarily the Persian Gulf region. Conveniently for the oil producers, they're countries with very small populations, so they don't have to distribute it very widely. So countries like Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, even Saudi Arabia, which doesn't have a large population, you're talking about dividing many billions of dollars among relatively few people. You get to some of the other more populous oil producers like Iran or Iraq or Algeria. You're talking about significant revenues, but in these cases, they have to be divided amongst many millions of people. Then you've got the countries like Egypt, like Tunisia, Mauritania, Yemen, countries that may have a little bit of oil themselves, but that's not a major economic factor for them. And although you can say these countries have been, in fact, brought into what we can call a regional oil economy, because many Yemenis, for instance, and Egyptians have been workers for many, many years in the Gulf region, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, and so forth. So they made money, which they sent back to their families in the form of remittances. So there was a way in which the oil economy really permeated the area. But, of course, there's tremendous divisions. I mean, just at the per capita level, you're talking about close to $20,000 per person per year in the United Arab Emirates. And per person means every man, woman, and child who's a citizen of that country. And then at the other end of the spectrum, a country like Mauritania or Sudan or Yemen, which is $300, $400, $500 a year. So there's, you know, that's quite a wide gulf. And as we know, these per capita figures really don't tell us much about the divisions or maldistribution of income within particular countries. So it's real between the sort of most lavish and indulgent lifestyles of the very rich in Kuwait, in Saudi Arabia, or in Egypt even. They do have their own local ruling class there too, which is not poor. And those who are living in the case of Egypt, in Cairo, in cemeteries even. I mean, just the most abysmal kinds of living conditions.
Could you compare how Kuwait and Iraq have used their oil money?
Well, it's at some level they've used it very similarly. That is, all these countries were starting off from a fairly low level of socioeconomic development. There were no industries, no serious significant infrastructure in the form of roads, schools, hospitals, and so on, 3 or 4 decades ago, as recently as the sort of aftermath of the Second World War. So since then, all these countries, including Iraq and Kuwait, have built up this infrastructure. As I indicated, Kuwait can do this very much more easily than a country like Iraq because it's a much smaller country geographically and it's much smaller in terms of population. This means, in effect, that once all the sort of basic import needs are met in terms of goods and services, that there's substantial revenues left over on the part of countries like Kuwait, which have very small populations. And these revenues are available for investment elsewhere. This is not the case for a country like Iraq.
Do you feel that there is a lot of resentment in the Arab world at how the Kuwaitis have used their money?
Oh, there very definitely is. And I think, in fact, it's been quite shocking, I think, to all of us who have some familiarity with the region, the extent to which this resentment has surfaced in the aftermath of this invasion of August. The Kuwaitis were far from the most profligate of the big Gulf spenders. They, of all the countries in the Gulf, were probably the most conscientious in terms of they were distributing in some years upwards of about 7% of their gross national product in the form of aid and investment locally to other Arab countries and to the Palestinian movement and so on and so forth. So there was they were seen as the most generous, in fact, of the Gulf states. But yet, despite that, they're identified with this status quo, this socioeconomic status quo, which people in the region view as a very unfair, manipulative sort of decoupling, the way the borders were drawn, decoupling Arab resources from Arab people. That's basically how it's seen in the region, and that's the root cause of this resentment.
Do the other Arab countries think that Kuwait should be investing in them instead?
Well, there's the general sense that this is Arab oil. It's not Kuwaiti oil or Saudi oil. That's the sense amongst people who are living elsewhere in Jordan, for instance, Palestinians, Egyptians, and so forth. So that's the basic dichotomy. To what extent should it be? It's a good question, too, I think. Who does this resource belong to? For a long time, it belonged to, in the sort of legal sense and in an effective financial sense, to the giant oil companies. Over the course of the 60s and 70s and into the early 80s, there was a process of takeover, where governments in the region bought out the giant oil companies and now are the legal owners of those resources. But then, you know, do they belong to the ruling families? I mean, we're talking about countries, Kuwait, the Emirates, Bahrain, and so on, where there's very little distinction made between the national budget and the expense account of the ruling family. I mean, this is another aspect of the problem there. It's a very small number of people controlling what amount to be a very significant proportion of total Arab resources.
I was just reading an article that appeared in the New York Times about the disco problem that's going on in Cairo.
Yeah.
Did you read about that?
I've seen reference to that, yeah. The night of the war broke out, Kuwaitis headed for the discos in Cairo, and I guess they haven't let up since.
Yeah, and it appears that Kuwaiti officials in exile are worried about what this might look like, that here are these young draft-age men from Kuwait who are out partying in the discos all night while young men from other countries are putting their lives on the line to protect Kuwait.
Yes, I think they should worry.
Why?
Well, because, I mean, again, it's an aspect of that resentment which this whole crisis episode has brought to the surface. It didn't create it. It just sort of let the genie out of the bottle, so to speak. I mean, these issues that we're discussing here of rich and poor, have and have not, sort of the class questions as they affect the Middle East and the Arab world, these are not new questions. I mean, maybe a little historical perspective would be useful. In the period after World War II through, say, the mid-late 1960s, this was very much on the agenda. The heyday of Arab nationalism, Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt at the forefront, the whole question of sort of some sort of political federation or unity that would enable the Arabs to act with some degree of political and economic unity and cohesion. This was very much on the agenda. A turning point in this whole process was the defeat that this Arab nationalist movement or tendency experienced in the late 1960s, including the 1967 war, where Israel very soundly and quickly defeated Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. And it was after that war, that war really marked a turning point in that the Arab nationalist trend, the sort of radical Arab nationalist trend typified by Nasser, went into a fairly steep decline. And the political role of the very conservative monarchies, like Saudi Arabia, the oil producers, really went into the ascendancy. And there was a deal struck, in effect, in the aftermath of the 67 war, where the rich states like Saudi Arabia basically said, look, cool your jets on this all this talk about redistribution of wealth and so on. You know, you're not in any position to make those demands anymore. So let us play a major role in political deployment. So, for instance, after that, in terms of the Arab-Israeli dispute or the what we might call the Arab-Israeli-U.S. triangle, it was those conservative Arab states that came to play a major role. And that deal, that truce sort of held from 1968 until, I would say, until 1990, until the summer of 1990. And I think that this invasion, Saddam's invasion of Kuwait, has just blown it sky high. I don't think he necessarily intended this. Saddam is not really a revolutionary. He's a bully. But it has had that effect, and I don't think the Middle East is going to be the same again.
My guest is Joe Stork. He's the co-founder and program director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, and he's the editor of their publication, The Middle East Report. Before the invasion, the majority of people living in Kuwait were guest residents, not citizens. Could you compare the situation of Kuwaiti citizens to the guest workers?
Well, to be a Kuwaiti citizen, you had to have been born in Kuwait of Kuwaiti citizens. Citizenship was restricted to a group of people, which by 1990 came to number roughly 700,000 people. A very, very small number. I'm talking like maybe 20 a year of other people would be allowed to take Kuwaiti citizenship. So you will find, for instance, some Palestinians who've been living and working there for generations themselves, several generations themselves, who now have Kuwaiti citizenship, but it's at this really sort of microscopic pace. Now, what citizenship means, of course, like in many other places, is that you have certain rights. They don't necessarily include vast political rights in the case of Kuwait, because Kuwait, the emir, the prince, had no compunction about dissolving the parliament whenever he felt like it. Voting was restricted to male Kuwaiti citizens, so we're talking about an even smaller number of the population. But that meant that of the, say, 2.5-3 million people in Kuwait, the two-thirds of them, at least, were non-Kuwaitis. They were other Arabs, like Palestinians and Egyptians. They were people from the subcontinent, Pakistanis, Bengalis, Indians, Filipinos, and so forth. It was just kind of a noblesse oblige, perhaps, but they were very vulnerable in every respect. They made out, many of them did very well in material terms. They made very good livings as architects, doctors, professionals, or at another level as cab drivers, as construction workers, and so forth. But whenever there was any political trouble, whenever there was any kind of economic downturn and the government decided it really didn't need all these workers, they would be deported. That's happened a number of times over the last 15 years. And even if you were, say, a lawyer practicing corporate law, and you were a Palestinian without Kuwaiti citizenship, it meant everything you did had to be done actually in the name of a Kuwaiti. You had to have a Kuwaiti partner who sort of signed off on everything and, you know, took half of the fees but did none of the work, basically just lent his umbrella of citizenship to the whole enterprise.
Within the Arab countries, there's often a talk about their support for the cause of the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that the wealthier nations in the Middle East have been there with generous financial support for the Palestinians?
Well, I guess it depends on your point of view exactly how generous it's been. I'm sure those governments have certainly argued that it's generous. The Palestinians have tended to take a different view of how generous it is. I think there is a very widespread popular support for the Palestinian cause, not over and above everything else that's going on in the region. And, of course, you're also dealing with regimes, not just the rich oil producers, but the other regimes, the Syrians, for instance, the Iraqis, the Egyptians, who basically put their own state and regime interests first and who have been great misusers, manipulators of the Palestinian cause. And I think the oil producers like the Saudis and the Kuwaitis have played along in that as well.
My guest is Joe Stork. He's the editor-in-chief of Middle East Report and the author of Middle East Oil and the Energy Crisis. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Stork, editor of the Middle East Report. Many of the countries in the Middle East are dictatorships, but I haven't really been hearing about any strong dissident movements in these countries. Can you tell us about dissent? Is there any?
Well, there are opposition movements in virtually every one of these countries, but depending on the effectiveness of the dictatorship, they're probably not too significant. I think it's worth noting that those countries where there has, in fact, been some measure of political liberalization over the last 4 or 5 years, and here we can enumerate Tunisia, Algeria, Jordan, and Yemen, these countries have seen the most vocal and the most widespread levels of popular opposition to the American military deployment in the region. And this is something that the American government, the Washington, is ignoring to their great peril, I think.
Do you know of any pro-democracy movements that are actually rather vocal in the region?
Oh, yes, there are. Certainly in all the countries I just mentioned, there are very strong pro-democracy movements. There's sort of a tricky situation there in that among the best organized of the opposition forces in several of these countries, including Algeria and Jordan, or Algeria and Tunisia anyway, the sort of Islamist fundamentalist types are the strongest. And of course, one of the dilemmas for liberal Democrats is do you press hard to open up the system so that the fundamentalists can essentially win power in election and then sort of close it down again? So that's certainly a very real dilemma facing Democrats in the region. But Democrats there are, and I've enumerated the countries where they've been most strong. They take the form of human rights groups, which have been established in every one of these countries and in Egypt over the last 5 to 10 years. They're not in any position to make a serious contest for power under the way the rules of the game are rigged at present, but they certainly exist, and they're organizing, and they're tapping into a very great dissatisfaction with the political status quo.
These dissident groups that are active, these pro-democracy dissident groups that are active in these countries, they're not supporting the United States, but what's their stand on Saddam Hussein?
Well, none of them like Saddam Hussein, I can assure you of that. They all see Saddam Hussein as an awful brute, quite frankly. And I think one of the great tragedies of the way the United States has conducted itself in this whole crisis is that it has basically undermined that kind of political opposition. It's made those people choose between Saddam Hussein and George Bush, fundamentally. And faced with that kind of a choice, very few of them are going to go, frankly, with George Bush for all the reasons I outlined, these sort of rich-poor questions. There's the whole question of Palestine-Israel and the very great sense resentment over U.S. hypocrisy, what is seen as U.S. hypocrisy around that question over the last several years. So for all kinds of reasons, there's just no way they could align with Washington.
Yesterday, James Baker presented the Bush administration's post-war vision for the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. And he said that efforts should be made to remove what he called one of the main sources of conflict, the feeling that the Arab oil-rich countries were not sharing their wealth with the other Arab countries. And he said it might be possible for a coalition of countries using both local and external resources to transform the outlook for the region in expanding free trade and investment and assisting development and in promoting growth-oriented economic policies. So once this war is over and these issues need to be addressed, how do you think that this gap between the haves and the have-nots in the area should be addressed after the war?
Well, I don't think James Baker should have any say in how it's going to be addressed, because frankly, I think it's outrageous that here a man who's played a role in implementing a policy which has resulted in this fantastic destruction is now coming along and basically saying, well, we are going to have to pick up the pieces. And essentially, read between the lines, what he's saying is there's lots of contracts there for rebuilding these bridges and these schools and these hospitals and these plants and roads that we're taking out every day with this air war. So, I mean, it's the height of hypocrisy for George Bush or James Baker to be talking now about these issues of rich and poor. However, hypocrisy, after all, is the compliment that vice pays to virtue, and it does at least signal a recognition that this issue, the question of rich and poor on the regional level, is on the table in a way that it has not been on the table since the late 1950s, early 1960s. Now, how it should be addressed, frankly, I don't think it's a question. I'm not sure how it should be addressed, but I think it's a question that the people of the region have to determine. The whole issue here really is, if you want to put it in a phrase, is self-determination. That's what's being denied here. And it's that sense of denial which is fueling this opposition to the U.S. Role in the region today. So I think the key thing is that there be essentially a very strong element of self-determination. And by self-determination, I don't mean, as I think James Baker means when he talks about an Arab role, I don't mean just the role of King Fahad or the Prince of Kuwait or whoever happens to be installed in Iraq after we're finished with it. We're not, you know, just because we have the agreement of a king or a president doesn't mean that we have the agreement and the support of the people or any significant part of the people in those countries. And I think some kind of device, some sort of political accommodation between the states, but also between the peoples of the region. This has to be allowed for.
Well, Joe Stork, thanks so much for coming and talking with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Joe Stork is a co-founder and program director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. They publish the magazine Middle East Report. I'm Amy Salad, and this is Fresh Air.